Greetings, friends. It's me, Duncan, and this is the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. Good morning to you. Well, if you're listening to this in the morning, I'm recording it on a Saturday morning. Here's something exciting. I am attempting to shift the DTFH to video mode. I know I've been saying this on and off for the last many years, but it's actually happening. And so I would love it if you would subscribe to my YouTube. You can find it by searching Duncan Trussell on YouTube. I'm going to start doing video intros. I actually tried to do one today, but ran into some technical difficulties. You video streamers make it seem so easy, don't you? So easy to set up multiple cameras, multiple angles, perfect audio, but it's not. It's really hard, but I'm going to do it. So go to my YouTube, won't you? Also, if you want commercial-free episodes of this, go to patreon.com/DTFH and subscribe. You'll get commercial-free episodes, and hopefully you can get access to our Discord servers. For those of you who are having trouble getting into the Discord, it appears, not positive about this, but it appears that our entire Discord server has been reset because one of you cretins out there posted some horrible image or something. I don't know. I sent an appeal to Discord. I'm trying to figure out what's happening, but stay tuned for that. Normally, when you subscribe to the Patreon, you get access to Discord, but until we work out whatever horrific thing someone posted, apparently it's gore. That's what I got in my email. We won't be able to get the Discord running, and I won't be able to get to that until Monday. So hang tight. We will restore our homeland. Today we have a wonderful guest, a recurring guest, Ramdev. I love him so much. He is really tight with Ram Dass. He actually got to hang out with Neem Karoli Baba and Ram Dass in India, and he's got so many cool stories that if you're somebody who has tuned into the Ram Dass wavelength, you may never have heard before. And some of them are here today. If you like Ramdev, check out the Living Dying Project. Go see him. He has a retreat coming up, which we talk about in this episode. And come see me. I'm going to be at Wise Guys in Las Vegas next week. It's March 11th right now. So that's going to be March 18th, 17th, and 16th in Vegas. You can find tickets at DuncanTrussell.com. And now, everybody, welcome back to the DTFH Ramdev. Ramdev, welcome back to the DTFH. How goes it?
And so glad to be with you, Duncan. Always a pleasure.
You know, here's my question for you that popped into my head. You're a longtime friend of Ram Dass in that community. One thing that's always been interesting to me is Ram Dass's connection with Emmanuel, the channeled entity. And I wondered if you had any thoughts at all about that relationship. What was it? And what are your thoughts on channeling?
Okay, well, for those of you guys who don't know, Emmanuel was a disembodied spirit. And when we were back in New York, Ram Dass and me and a whole bunch of the Maharaji people ended up in New York studying with a woman named Joya. That's a whole other story
that we could
get into sometime. It was very dramatic. She ended up being a wonderful meditation teacher, but sort of needed to feel she was the highest human being, highest female being in form.
It was a cult.
Right. And anyway, we were back there and Ram Dass met a woman named Pat Rodegast who channeled Emmanuel. And Ram Dass had this line that just because you don't have a body doesn't mean you can't be wise or smart or something like that. I don't know. So I actually went to a reading with Pat Rodegast. Emmanuel talked to me. He said I was going to fall in love and get married at a certain time. It didn't happen. He told me a bunch of other things that didn't happen. But he seemed to have some kind of good generic spiritual wisdom that anybody could have gotten out of a book. So I was a little bit skeptical, but Ram Dass knew the woman who was channeling Pat, who was a very good friend of another friend of Ram Dass's, and I don't know really what to say. I mean, to me, it just felt like a little weird, I have to admit, but you know, at the same time, we were around Maharaji, and all kinds of completely crazy things happened there.
Right.
The main book Ram Dass put together about Maharaji was called Miracle of Love, and what the title kind of is implying that Maharaji could do all these miracles. He could know the past. He could know the future. It seemed like he could be in two places at the same time. But the real miracle is how much he loved. That put all the other miracles to shame.
Right.
Right. And I didn't feel that from Emmanuel. He had some wisdom, but it didn't seem like a big deal to me. And so, I mean, even the things that Maharaji did that, or Emmanuel, that could seem like miraculous or out of the ordinary, if you really start looking at quantum mechanics these days, they're kind of showing. I mean, some guys just got the Nobel Prize for quantum entanglement that shows that basically there's only one thing, the universe, one song. There's just one sub-act. It's all one. And so that if you're living at that state of non-duality, this idea of time and past and present and future and here and there and all that stuff, it doesn't make any sense anymore because you're everywhere and everything. So from that perspective, there are people maybe you could say they're tuning into Jung's collective unconscious, that it's not a miracle, that everything's out there. All the information that's happened is going to happen. Parallel universes. I mean, who knows, right?
Yeah.
So
so is Pat still around?
I don't know. I have no idea. I mean, I kind of doubt it. She seemed to be about maybe Ram Dass's age, but you know, he would be like about 90 years old now, probably. No, he'd be older than that. He'd be like about 94 if he were alive, I think.
You know,
because he was 11 years older than me. So he'd be 91. I don't know. My numbers are all crazy here. I've got a PhD in math, but I can't do arithmetic. What do you know about that?
Well, yeah, I understand. I get that. I'm the same way, except minus the PhD in math. I'm interested for a few different reasons. One being, you know, you all were sort of in the nucleus of what later became known as the New Age movement, and channeling was such a big part of that culture. I mean, you had Ramtha, you had Emmanuel, you had a myriad other of these people who claimed to be able to become host to these entities. My mother was so into Ramtha rather. She loved Ram Dass too,
right, right.
Ramtha,
right.
Very into Ramtha. I went to see Ramtha channel in Asheville, North Carolina. And I did feel something, but then, you know, maybe I'm a sucker, I don't know, but I did feel like a palatable energy shift. I felt a presence. I also had a very skeptical mind, wanted to believe it's true. And I had a channeler on my show live once. Now, this was one of my bigger podcast mistakes, because by that time I gotten very cynical, very skeptical. And the friend who suggested this channeler, he was connected with all these spiritual people in New York, and wasn't the sort of person who would just like give you something that was bullshit. But the channeler comes to the show, it's live podcast we're doing, and he just seems real normal. And so I'm thinking to myself, well, this is going to be a bust. I sold tickets for this. I feel like an asshole. He starts channeling this entity, and people in the front row, they just start crying. It was like sitting next to like too much energy. It was hard to stay still. It was like whatever was coming out of him was like waving out, rippling out into the room. And he, the way he does, some channelers or possessed, I guess that's probably a nicer word for it than possessed, but the being comes out of them. He does audio clear, I can't remember the specific name, where the thing comes out of him, he hears it and repeats it. So this thing, machine gun, way too fast, so fast. It's spitting out these brilliant sentences, but it's like a, it's obviously it's English, but it's like Morse code or something. So those are two weird experiences I've had with it, and both to me confirm that this phenomena, whatever it may be, I get why people are drawn into it. So it's interesting to hear that the Emmanuel to you just kind of felt like somebody picked up some New Age books and was regurgitating some of that stuff.
Well, I'm not saying that exactly. Maybe it sounded like that. And if I did, I apologize. I guess what I'm saying is, like, for instance, I just taught a Zoom workshop over the weekend, and somebody wrote to me and said, "I really loved your stream of consciousness, the way it was structured." And so, I mean, like, what I try to do, like, right now when I'm with you or all the time, is get as open as I can get. I have this embodied mindfulness. I try to open my heart. And then just like let my mouth start flapping around. And is Dale Ramdev doing it, or is Maharaji speaking through me, or I don't know. And it might just be that Pat Rodegast and that person on your show was a very high being who could go into some altered state where the wisdom of the universe flows through, and they happen to call it Ramtha or Emmanuel, or maybe they're doing that for marketing reasons or whatever. But I mean, what was Maharaji channeling? Like, what are you channeling right
See,
now,
you're
right?
a
I mean,
step
it's all
ahead of
kind of
me.
levels of channeling.
You're a step ahead of me. That's where I was trying to get to. You've leapfrogged me. That's what I was trying to get to. That's where I wanted to get to.
Let
That's
me give you a quote. Let me give you a
okay.
quote that I just read in a book by my friend Andy Lamott yesterday.
She's the best.
God is the worst nickname ever. Okay.
It really is. Surely we could have come up with a better nickname. Surely the It's like when it's when you're vomiting. It's like there has to be a better thing than it's just starting with that G. It's that hard gah.
So, but what I'm saying is that we're all channeling God, right? I mean, whether you call it Jesus or Emmanuel or Ramtha or Maharaji or Duncan's deeper voice or whatever it is. I mean, it's like, I mean, basically spiritual practice is about disidentifying with ego structure and identifying with true nature and just letting that flow through you unimpeded, right? So that maybe some of these channelers were people that had a certain ability, maybe they're not enlightened, but they had this one ability at least to really get out of the way and tune into the wisdom that's always floating around. I mean, like, if you think about it, right now, the worst rap music on the worst radio station in your neighborhood is going through your body, right? It's, I mean, it's all there, all those radio waves, right? All the information's available in some way, right? So these channels are able to tune into that. You're able to tune into it sometime to a certain degree. I am.
Well, no, I mean, I know. This is exactly. I'm curious. This is like the. This is what I'm very curious about. Is, you know, if you do the slightest self-reflection in the midst of talking, and try to tune in, well, where are the words coming from? I mean, if I had to spend any amount of time contemplating the next word out of my mouth, then I would stutter. I wouldn't be capable of maintaining any kind of conversation at all. And somewhere in there, it feels like the bottom drops out, that we so want to lay claim to what we say. You know, it came out of my mouth, it must be me. But when you analyze the situation of just speaking at all, you're not really spending too, well, if you're me, you're definitely not spending much time thinking about what you're about to say. You're just
Right.
letting it go. But
Right.
somewhere in there, you also have to let go of ownership over what you say, even though people are like, no, you said that, asshole. What the fuck? You can't let go of ownership. When you look at it, you realize, like, yeah, but I wasn't thinking about what I was. There might be some feelings behind it, but the articulation of reality itself seems to be emerging from an abyss. And I would love to know your thoughts on what that abyss is.
Well, my friend, there's this famous quote, the mind creates the abyss, the heart crosses it. And there's this fundamental paradox in spiritual life that because we're suffering, because we're conditioned, we're trying to find a safe, solid space from which to view life, live life. But in fact, reality is groundless. There's no permanent self. Everything's impermanent. Everything's changing. There's not really an I when you get right down to it. In Buddhism, they talk about anicca, dukkha, anatta, the three characteristics of existence: no permanent self, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness. So there's this tension between some part of me that wants to be in control and know what's going on, and I'm Dale and I'm Ramdev and I'm doing this stuff, and hopefully you're going to like me and all those kind of things. And there's this other part that's just like, it's all spaciousness. It's nobody's doing anything. There's not an I. And for most people, it's a very gradual process of trusting this dying into life, or you could even say dying into love. That the abyss, I mean, if you really think about loving somebody, it's an abyss.
Yeah.
Because it's this mystery between two people, or between you and God, or between you and your true self or something, right?
Yeah.
It's like, it's this unknown thing. It's a mystery. You surrender to the mystery. And then you pull back and say, wait a minute, that's too big. That's too spacious.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was going to these long meditation retreats back before I became a parent, I had these experiences where my mind would get really quiet, and I think, I'd just be watching that. I wouldn't be thinking at all, actually. And then some thoughts would come, and I'd be aware of the thoughts after a short and not so short amount of time. They'd go away. There'd be spaciousness, and then some thoughts, and then some awareness of thoughts. But if I really paid very careful attention, because I was curious, why would I start thinking when it felt so good to be resting in the abyss? Right? And right before I started thinking, there was fear of the abyss. There was fear of death.
Yes.
There was like, I believe Descartes. I think therefore I am. So let's start thinking so I can reify the ego structure.
Yeah.
Rather than just resting in this bliss of openness.
Yeah.
Because there's nobody doing the resting. It's like floating in the vast sky of mind. And one part of me is saying, hey, this is fantastic. But the ego structure, this part of me that's based on survival, right, says, hey, wait a minute, you're forgetting about me. Come back here. Let's think. Let's have some dualism here.
Right.
I don't like the abyss. The abyss is very big.
Well, you know, it's like if you go back and apply like this same conundrum when it comes to speaking or thought origination. I know in like neurobiology, there's some very creepy data that seems to suggest that before you even become aware of what you're going to say, your brain has already determined, now this is what we're going to say.
Right.
Similarly with thoughts, you know, if you start any kind of sitting practice where you're allowing your thoughts just to do their thing without reacting to them so much, you run into the same exact identical problem, which is, you know, you're not like cooking your thoughts up in some kind of sulfuric kitchen that where you're like, God, let me just think the worst fucking thing ever, throw in a little Ukraine war, toss in a little COVID, mix it up with some the polar shift, impending apocalypse. And then, I don't know, yeah, think about how I was a shitty kid. Let's tie all those things together, and then voila, you think some neurotic thought. No, the neurotic thought comes from the same abyss. So when you talk about this, well, you know, I decided to start thinking. Who decided? That seems to be yet another trick. It seems like at some point, making enough contact with that nucleus or whatever you want to call it, abyss seems like a little sinister. I like that we're calling it an abyss. I mean, anyone who's having any encounter with emptiness doesn't really feel like an, when I think of Abyss, I think of H.P. Lovecraft. I don't think, you know, it's like right. tentacles, but this is more of like, come like a waking, like, oh, this is what I've always been thing. And then these safety parachute thoughts that are, that you're ejecting to desperately try to stop your plummet into whatever this thing is. You're not even deciding to eject the parachute, right? Like it just is, it just seems to be an automatic function when you are in that zone, like that, but you're not really deciding to think. You know what I mean? Like, you're not like, oh shit, I need to think, because that's a thought too.
So that, I mean, it even goes into the body that before you decide to move your hand to pick up the fork, the hand is moving before the mind says, hey, I think I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, Ram Dass has this great metaphor that the spiritual life is like jumping out of an airplane and partway down realizing there's no ground.
Yeah.
I mean, screwed it up. Partway down realizing you don't have on a parachute.
Yeah.
And then a little further way down, you realize it's okay because there's no ground.
Right.
But in that space in the middle between no parachute and no ground, it's really scary because you think rocks might be coming up as you're falling down here.
Right. Right. Yeah. Somehow within whatever this is, you're essentially experiencing death, right? Like that's the idea, is that prior to, you know, whatever analogy you want to use, deploying your parachute, using your anti-grav suit, whatever the thing is you want to do, prior to that, you've already come home, right? Like that's the idea. It's like right before you decide to start the machine up again, the experience is one of like, oh, this is me. This is what I've always been. This is more me than me. I don't know why that is so terrifying, though I agree with you. I mean, I've certainly gone scampering away from that so many times, meditating on psychedelics or whatever. Just like,
right.
I need to be something. I gotta be a thing, you know? But why? Because it seems like a real encounter with a thing is not really, I wouldn't use the term frightening.
But I mean, to me, it seems like, Duncan, that there is so much conditioning from early childhood where we were conditioned out of trusting our openness, our natural impulses, that you got to be socialized. You can't piss on the floor. You can't write on the wall.
Yeah.
You got to be quiet because dad's trying to read the paper or whatever's going on,
yeah.
Right? So you've got to listen to the superego. You've got to listen to this voice that's telling you how to behave. And that voice is telling you, I'm the voice of survival. If you don't listen to me, they might not feed you. They might not protect you anymore. You got to be a good boy. So there's two responses. Either I'm going to be a good boy or I'm going to be a rebel and I'm going to be a bad boy. But they're two sides of the same coin, right?
Right.
So that we grow up and we're still doing that. We're still believing that's the voice of survival. And spiritual life is gradually learning to trust that we can die into the next moment. And for many of us, it's dying into love. Can we trust our heart? Can we trust the heart space enough to die into the next moment? That love brings a sense of mercy and softening so that this surrender, this dying, is dying into this vulnerability is something we can bear. We're learning to bear what was previously unbearable through practice.
So you were talking about the sort of, you know, if I, you know, you learn either to be a good boy, do what mommy says, be a bad boy, don't do what mommy says, but whatever you're doing is still a reaction. It, no matter what, you're still wrapped up in your identity, still wrapped up in
you know, there's no autonomy there. You're just different sides of the same coin. I think is that what you're trying to say?
But then again, you think about somebody like Brezhnikov leaping on the stage or Willie Mays catching a fly ball or something. There's nobody doing that. So that whether you're a meditator or an athlete or a creative person or something, or you're taking psychedelics or whatever it is, that we seek out these places in life where we go beyond I'm doing it, where we're letting life flow through us. We're letting Shakti, just letting that juice just be expressed through us. And just getting in that flow, feeling that connectedness. One of the defining heart, one of the defining qualities of the open heart is connectedness. Right now, do I feel connected to you? Do I feel connected to my own self? Do I feel connected to the guy with the bad nickname God, right? Do I, or am I disconnected? Am I back? I've got to protect myself. I've got to figure out what's going on. And that sense of connection is going beyond I, me, mine, right? What you are looking for is who is looking. But we're so conditioned that we're practicing from a feeling of inadequacy and need and poverty, and we've got to find something to become better. And when practice deepens enough, we get to the place of abundance and richness, and we're practicing because we're living because we enjoy it, because God's expressing through us. Life is flowing through us. And that's a big shift where you're not feeling, I've got to meditate, I've got to do this or that because I'm no good until I do it better.
Let's talk about, since we spend a lot of time talking about the connection, let's talk about the disconnect, the experience of disconnect. Can you describe what that's like for you?
Well, I was just talking yesterday with a friend of mine, and I was talking about my connection with God, which is one specific issue. And maybe 10 or 15 years after Maharaji died, I felt like he abandoned me. I felt disconnected. Up until then, I dream about him, I could feel him. And so for a year or two, I felt disconnected, and I felt like I'm a bad devotee. He's abandoned me because I've been goofing around too much, right? And then I got this message that no, he's just saying it's time for I'm going to stop holding your hand. It's time for you to jump out of the nest, mixing a few metaphors here, and fly on your own, right? And so that it was not being connected with some idea of God or Maharaji in the pictures or, you know, Christ in the mantra or whatever it is, but just trusting true nature, trusting who I am. And just in the last few weeks, though, it's been feeling like that really sweet presence is coming back, whether you call that Maharaji or whatever. But all of a sudden now, something in me is trusting that there is that connection. And sometimes I feel that with people. I often feel it in bed late at night, like I'm going to bed. And I put my head down on the pillow. Am I putting my head on the pillow or is I putting it in God's lap? And I'm lying there and I've got this job where I meet a lot of people who are dying and suffering and grieving and all that. So I try to think of these people and just say my mantra and feel love for people. Not that they're broken and I need to fix them. Not that they're even people that are separate, but that I go into wholeness and connection and then I connect with them. Like when I was younger and all these yogis, swamis, lamas, roshis were coming to the Bay Area, and I was like a big yogi and I needed all the help I could get. I'd go to these people and I'd ask them my test question. The test question was, what would I do if I had a friend who were dying and they'd never meditated and I really wanted to help them? What would be the best thing to do? And almost all of them said something like, merge your mind with the one mind. And then merge your mind with your friend. So you're not looking at them as a dying person, or you're not looking at them as something separate from you, but you're looking at them as they're one with God and you're one with God. And then, like, there's that line in the J.D. Salinger short story where this little enlightened kid saw somebody drinking milk and he saw God pouring God into God, right? So that it's all connected. Maharaji would say sub-ek all the time. It's all one. And once again, these people just got the Nobel Prize for there's just one thing in the universe, right? Essentially, yeah. Universe, one song, only one. So the further I go down this path, the more it's about surrendering into that oneness and less about me trying to do something to fix something. That it's letting go of I'm in this big self-improvement project. But yeah. that it's like Suzuki Roshi, my first meditation teacher, said to his students, you're all perfect, but there's still some room for some improvement.
Right. Now, okay. So to me, I feel like this is the sort of the double-edged sword of the guru is that it produces an addiction, an inevitable addiction. How do you not become addicted to somebody who is reminding you of home, who is like, smell, you know, like when you walk into your home after a long trip or something, you know, it's like, oh my God, this place. How do you not get addicted to that? And you bringing up this sense of like being pushed out of the nest or whatever, this is where it gets really curious. The entire self-help movement, so much of the teacher-student relationship that appears in capitalism, the teacher needs to sell books. They need to eat. In other words, to push the bird out of the nest, to, you know, help them get to some place of like, no, you don't need me anymore because you are me. It actually could hurt ticket sales. You know what I mean? Like, this to me seems like where things could potentially get a little weird, which is, I'm not denying that some people have like made a profound connection to this place. But it's odd, isn't it, when like you need to keep telling stories about the place. But you know what I mean? Like you have to tell stories about the place instead of getting people to the place to tell their own stories about the place. You know what I mean?
I hear what you're saying, but I really think there's a difference between a teacher and a guru.
Okay.
And you say that you become addicted to the guru, but if somebody really is a guru, all they want is your happiness, your freedom. And when you get to the point where you don't need to be addicted anymore, then they help you break that addiction. Whereas somebody is out there selling their CDs and their books and their workshops and all that stuff, maybe that's much more the beginning and middle stages of the path. And people need to have those teachers. People need to learn how to meditate and learn how to trust themselves and stuff. But this final surrender into wholeness, into love, is a whole different level of the game that we're talking about. And certainly there are people who claim to be enlightened beings, and you read stories about their sexual indiscretions or they're scamming money or who knows what they're doing. So somebody once asked Maharaji, how do you know if somebody's your guru? And he said, do you feel that they can completely bring you to total liberation or not? If you don't feel that, then they're not their guru. They're just some teacher along the way.
Wow. Cool. Wow. That must be an incredible thing to be around that, to have no doubts about it, to know for sure that whoever this being is, they could do that for you. What was that experience like for you?
Well, think about it. In the beginning, you do have to doubt. You do have to check it out. Is this somebody I can trust or not? If you just come in there with blind faith, you're going to end up with some shyster guru. You're going to end up with some phony. I mean, you might, and I'm not saying you will, but there's a chance that you're just somebody who wants your money or your body or whatever.
Yeah.
They've got a few good lines of teaching and here, give me all your stuff. But then eventually, if you're keeping doubting and checking it out all the time, you're really limiting the depth of surrender that can happen. So you get to the point where you choose, is this my guru, is this not my guru? And if you say yes, then you let go of all the doubt. You just completely dive in there. And certainly there are people that have made a mistake at that point. But when I was around Maharaji in the beginning, I was kind of believing who he was because Ram Dass said so, and Ram Dass seemed to be my older brother. He'd been with Maharaji before. He knew Maharaji way better than I did, right in the beginning there at least. And I remember there was, I mean, let me just tell you this one story. So I was with Maharaji right in the beginning of getting there. And there was me and this guy, Steve, who's now, his name is Mohan, and a bunch of other devotees. And Maharaji turned to the two of us Westerners and he said, "How much do you guys pay for milk in America?" And Steve made a quick calculation in his head and said, "X rupees per kilo, Maharaji." And Maharaji turned to the Indians and said, "Can you believe how much they pay?" And he talked for 10 minutes to these people about the price of milk in America. And I'm starting to doubt that Ram Dass knows what he's talking about, that maybe this guy's senile. I didn't come to India to talk about the price of milk in America. I wanted God. I wanted important discussion, right? And he turned back to us and he said, "How much was it again?" And Mohan said, "X rupees per kilo, Maharaji." And Maharaji turned to the Indians and once again, he was going into this whole big talk. And I'm saying, this is crazy. And all of a sudden, I had this explosion in my mind where I knew it came from Maharaji. I can't tell you how. And he said, "We could talk about important stuff. We could talk about God. I could try to convince you because I'm so clever or something. But that just makes the mind busy. If we're just talking about bullshit, just the mundane, there's this ocean of bliss that's always available right now." And I just fell into this ocean of bliss. And I was so deeply in bliss that I could barely do anything for the rest of the day.
Right.
Right. So that Maharaji in that moment showed me that it wasn't about my mind, it was about surrender. And when I surrendered, which we can do right now, it's got nothing really to do with being in India, in Kenchi at a temple or something like that, that right now it's possible for us to surrender in that way, and that the greatest love, the greatest openness is available. And then the ego says, "But wait a minute, that's pretty scary, because what happens to me then?"
You know, my ego's trick around that is not that scary.
I'm waiting.
My ego says it's too easy. That's my ego isn't afraid of it. It seems like, or hasn't gone to the fear card yet. Usually the card it plays is, "You can't, that's too easy. No. You have to suffer. Maharaji stood in a lake and stared at the sun. You got to go into a mystery school. There are thorny belts that you must lash yourself with. Or, you know, pain, torture, crucifixion. Father, why have you forsaken me? Penance. Burn off the karma, man. You can't just dive into an infinite."
You believe that?
What?
That you have to do penance, you have to have a belt of thorns and stand in a lake for a year to be enlightened?
Not at all. My ego thinks that, but anytime I've experienced it, initially, yes, I believe that, but you know, I know what you're talking about. You know, and when I first met Ram Dass, and I was in a swimming pool and I couldn't believe it. Like, I'm hanging out with Ram Dass. It's right after my mom died. And then he pointed at me, he goes, "I want to talk to you." And he said it really fun, in a funny, fierce way, you know? And then, and then when we were in his house, I remember he wheeled up to me. And it's just what you're talking about, you know, just what you're talking about. That experience of like, what is happening? And he pointed it at his head. He said, "You're here." And then he pointed to his heart and he goes, "You have to get to here." And he goes, we can do that. You know, he didn't use a lot of words, obviously, because of the stroke. So
right.
He had a very concise way of saying things. But I remember saying to him, "Well, that's hard." Because I'm thinking that's not just hard. That's, you don't know me, man. I'm not getting out of my head. And and then he got this big smile and he goes, "No, it's not." and so this has been my experience lately. And but within that experience, there is it's very funny, the reaction that the part of you that wanted to work for it has. You know, it's that story. What's the story? in the Bible. You probably know it. A guy hires workers in the morning. Then in the
evening. Yeah, I used to know that one.
Workers in the morning.
And then he keeps paying them the same amount at the end of the day.
Pays them all for a day's work. And the ones in the morning are like, what the fuck? They work for like 20 minutes. You're going to pay them for a full day's work? That's not fair. And then that's sort of one of the, I think, the stories about the kingdom of heaven. Right. You know, this doesn't matter, your work. This isn't about work. That's the world. The world wants you to sweat and grind away to get the Ferrari or whatever.
Let me make a couple of points here. One is that Maharaji maybe needed to stand in a lake for a year and stare at the sun and things because he needed to be a teacher of the level of Maharaji, right? Like, for instance, in Buddhism, there are these things called the Jataka tales where the Bodhisattva, who was the Buddha before he became the Buddha, he vowed to become the Buddha. So he had to go through all these incarnations not to get enlightened, but become the actual Buddha. Like, for instance, in one incarnation, he was like walking out in the woods and he heard this sound and he looked down in this ravine and there was a tiger that had fallen in there, and the tiger and her two tiger cubs were there and they were going to starve to death because the tiger had hurt herself falling down into the ravine. So the Bodhisattva threw himself into the ravine so the tiger could eat him and he could save the three of them at the cost of his single life, right? So he was going through all these incarnations to become the Buddha. Yes. So maybe you and I don't need to become the Buddha. We just need to become enlightened Duncan, enlightened Ramdev, right? And Ramdas was, he needed to be Ramdas. He had some kind of karma. He had this really big karma to affect hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. I don't have that karma. I affect a few thousand people, maybe, and it's not really about numbers, but some people have that other kind of karma.
Wait a minute. Hold on. Let me stop you before the Gurdjieff. You've been talking about quantum entanglement. You've been talking about how we're all intrinsically, fundamentally connected, how this thing that everyone knows.
Got it.
Right? So from that perspective, let me tell you, would you rather, what's worse, old age, disease, death, living an entire life, or getting eaten by a tiger? I mean, we're getting eaten by a tiger in slow motion. It looks like the universe, and it is eating us, and it eats everybody. So I would argue, if this is a consensual relation thing that's happening here, in other words, if we chose this birth, then we signed up to get eaten by a tiger the size of the universe. So you're getting eaten by a tiger right now.
Yeah, but it's maybe a little bit. I mean, first of all, I'm enjoying life. I mean, if I actually had a tiger come into my room right now and started chewing on my leg, it would be a lot less pleasant than talking to you. If I actually had a tiger come into my room right now and started chewing on my leg, it would be a lot less pleasant than talking to you.
Hey, what is it? What is it from the? Yeah, okay. Well, thank you. That's nice. That would have been amazing if you said otherwise. I would rather be eaten by a tiger than continue to do your podcast. What was the story you mentioned? Drinking the milk. How does it go again?
That Maharaji was talking about the price of milk and I got all bored and then...
No, not that. The story about the kid in that short story.
It was the J.D. Salinger, not Maharaji. The J.D. Salinger story, one of the short stories in Franny and Zooey or Ray's Hive, the roof beams, carpenter, whatever it is, where there was this enlightened little boy looking at another child drinking milk, and what he saw was God pouring God into God.
Right. So Thai Buddha pouring, you know, the same thing's true for the Buddha and the tiger. We're talking about like, if, you know, that you're from the outside, you're like, what the, why did my friend just feed himself to a tiger? We had meat back at the palace. You know, that's something, that story I always think about. Like, didn't he have a sandwich? Like, wasn't there other things you could feed the starving tiger than yourself? But then that's taking a metaphor literally.
Yeah, I was just going to say it might be a metaphor, but the point is that to become a Buddha, you got to do maybe a different kind of practice than to become an enlightened Duncan. You know, that's my point. And the other point is that Gurdjieff said that the first thing you got to do on the path is let go of your attachment to your own suffering, right? And that's a hard thing to do because it's so, my victimhood, my suffering is so comfortable and familiar. Oh. And to be somebody who's not doing that means that who I think I am has to die. I've got to become a different person. So like, think of the metaphor of somebody's been incarcerated for like 20 or 30 years. I used to teach meditation in San Quentin. Right. And there are these stories of somebody's been in the joint for a really long time and they get paroled and they don't want to leave because it's so big and scary out there. Right. There's freedom out there, but they're so comfortable being in the cage. Right. So, so that spiritual life is about gradually getting used to being out of the cage. And then you go back in for a while, and then you, let me try that again. And then you go out there, and maybe you can spend a little more time out of the cage. But you want to sleep there at night because when it's dark out, it's too dangerous to be outside of the cage, metaphorically. You hear what I'm saying?
It's safe. My dogs like their crates. You know, they like to sleep in them at night. It's like, you know, they feel safe in there. I mean, there's one of my favorite examples of this is, have you ever read The Painted Bird by Jerzy Kaczynski?
No, I have not.
Oh, it's good, and it's horrible. But a little boy, you know, wandering through the countryside towards the end of World War II, it's awful. But encountering just horror after horror. But one of the things that, like, there's a rabbit hutch, and he's like sneaking around. There's he's this rabbit hutch, and he feels bad. There's this big fat rabbit stuck in the hutch, and so the little boy goes and opens up the rabbit hutch, and Kaczynski just describes this beautiful forest that is in front of this rabbit, this big fat rabbit, and how the rabbit kind of hobbles down, sniffs the air outside its cage, and then just walks right back into its cage.
Right.
And then, and yeah, it's he's pointing to this same phenomenon. I mean, this is like when you're, how many times, I'm sure you've heard this before, your friend has been bitching about their rotten relationship forever. And you have been saying to them, look, this is bad for you. Like, you're miserable. What are you doing? And then finally, they do it. They end the relationship. Then they call you 3 weeks later, and they're like, we got back together. And you're like, what are you doing?
It happens all the time.
Yeah. All the time. Yeah. All the time. Because it's that familiarity. It's like you would rather be in a familiar hell than a brand new heaven. It feels safer to be in hell. It's so odd. Humans are we're really messed up.
But then think of the function of the guru, that you're hanging out with this guy or this woman, and they keep seeing the place in you where you are whole. They keep, no matter how neurotic or horny or scared or inadequate you feel, they just keep seeing the place in you that's whole, and you begin to start believing that a little bit. I mean, there's this one teacher of non-duality, I don't even remember his name, but they asked him, how did you get enlightened? And he said, well, my teacher told me I wasn't, I believed them. So
That's cool.
He was obviously ready to do the surrender trick there, but that is what's going on here, that love is contagious. Those who haven't got it catch it from those who do. And whether it's from a guru or it's from your dog or it's from your wife or it's from your kid or it's from the tree in the front yard or whatever it is, that there's this process of beginning to gradually trust the surrender into wholeness and into love. there's this wonderful Rumi poem where there's this guy in the poem, he's complaining that I've been praying all my life and I've never heard God reply. I pray and you don't say anything. And in the poem, God replies to the guy, the longing you express is the return message. The grief you cry out from draws you toward union. Your pure sadness is the secret cup. You know, so it's not like, it's even talking about it. It's even wanting to know how to surrender. Even that is the response. That God loves us exactly the way we are. And we've got this thing in our heads, we've got to change to be more lovable. And that's the paradox.
That's what I'm talking about. That's the paradox. And I think this is like, you know, this is where I connect with the second noble truth. Because, you know, everyone thinks initially you hear that, it's like, yeah, right, you're attached to money or sex or this or that. But they never think, no, you're attached, you've become completely attached to pain, to suffering. And this seems ridiculous because why would I be, I'm take my hand away from the hot stove. What are you talking about? I'm not going to do that. I'm not this victim. It's to become a victim is this luxury almost, you know, like now you're a victim. You don't have to do anything. You're trapped. You're in the cage. There's no way out. And you don't want to deal with the possibility that, yeah, but you know, it's what does C.S. Lewis say? The gates of hell are locked from the inside.
Oh,
this is hilarious. That's a good line. Yeah, but to sort of realize that, oh my God, I am literally like I've met my dream girl. Finally, yeah, met my dream girl, but I'm just gonna stick it out with this monster that I've been that's been cheating on me, lying to me, sneaking around, stealing from me. You know, I definitely I don't mean that literally in my own life, you know. I'm saying like when you meet this thing, it's a lover.
We might elect Trump again.
What's that?
We might elect Trump again.
We did elect Trump again, but they lied about the polls.
Oh, that's
do you not watch Tucker Carlson?
I forgot about that. I guess I missed that show. But the point is that, I mean, even collectively, we're doing the same thing that we're talking about. It's not just you and me. It's the collective.
Yeah, yes, that's it. The collective is in an abusive relationship with their shadow and just lost in it. And you know, like any other abusive relationship, it's an egregore. Have you ever heard that term before? Egregore?
I have not.
It's a great term. It's a word for when enough people believe in a thing, whatever it may be, it becomes real in within the minds. And then in that way, it kind of takes on a life of its own outside of the minds via the action of the collective, the egregore. So in this case, the world has fallen in love with the egregore of the apocalypse. We love it. We are engaged in it. And if you compare it to it, classic abusive relationships, it's really not that different.
Right.
You know, and it because it's not real necessarily, any more real than the fact it's always been the apocalypse since the world existed, the thing itself, the forms it takes, it's the news, doom scrolling, fixation on war, never ending fear of disease, reactionary attitudes towards things that are being held in front of you by the priests of the egregore, you know, the media, and it's a terrible love affair. What you're talking about is the soulmate, you know, that is just patiently waiting for you to wake the fuck up, delete the number, delete the apocalypse's number out of your phone, block it, come watch Netflix with me.
Maharaji said, be peaceful, I am always with you, I'm always in communion with you. And that he's not just saying that to somebody who happened to be in India and happened to bump into him, but that God, Christ, Buddha, whoever it that presence, that wholeness is always there. And that conversation we were having about a quarter of an hour ago about what you have to do to get there, and the superego and the inadequate self saying you've got to try harder and suffer a lot to get there. I mean, in a way, it's so, as you pointed out, and we kind of slipped over that point, that to me is a really important thing, that it's so simple and so easy that we miss it. It's so familiar that it's here all the time and we don't notice it, that wholeness. And that we're always getting fixated with the content of experience or the observer, on the other hand. And really, it's just consciousness being with experience. That there's the seer seeing the seen. Yeah. You let go of the seen and the seer. All that's left is seeing. They were just seeing what's going on, but there's nobody doing it. And consciousness is creating form according to quantum mechanics. Without consciousness, there's no form. So that it's all consciousness. It's all God. And it's so simple. I mean, from the standpoint of non-duality, they talk about being aware of being aware, or awareness watching awareness, instead of getting lost up in all the content. Or from a devotional standpoint, of dying into love. Just, I mean, suppose instead of paying attention to your breath, you did this sort of like devotional Vipassana thing where you're paying attention to unconditional love in each moment. What does that feel like in your body, that love that's permeating every cell of your body and just hanging out there?
The best. It's like holding my children. If you're on your first date with somebody and they tell you they're complicated,
you believe them.
You better believe them. You better believe them. Make that your last date. Make it your last date. I mean, I think that if you want to sort of like, because we're dealing with like, but it's the phantom that gets embodied in all the myths. It's the phantom of, you know, Jesus in the desert. It's the phantom of Mara. It's the pre-enlightenment. But what do they all have in common? They're fucking complicated. Mara's complicated. Satan is so complicated. Like, there's contracts. You're messing around with the devil. There's like long, complex contracts in the myth, you know? And I think that represents the opposite of what you're talking about. It's like the world is complicated. There are forms. You can't just get a colonoscopy. You got to fill out 100 forms before they will shove a tube in your ass. You know what I mean? Like, this is the world. And so what you're talking about, it's like, it's so unfamiliar to people. It's so unfamiliar that it seems impossible. And then if we give a little life to the complexity, little intelligence, then it will, in the same way, a shitty person will say, that's way out of your league, man. You don't deserve that. Look at you. You're not symmetrical. Look at you. Have you seen your ass lately? Look in the mirror.
So, Duncan, when I was younger, I was in very complicated relationships with very exciting women. And there's like a lot of drama and passion and excitement and complication. And I'm old enough now that I'm not interested in complication. I've got a simple relationship finally in my life. I mean, somebody who's mature and loving, and we'd rather be happy than complicated, you know? I mean, and
yeah. That's cool.
Not just a relationship with another person, but my relationship with myself, my relationship with you, or, you know, with what I'm doing. It can be simple moment to moment. I mean, imagine. So there are three qualities of the totally awakened mind. One is clarity, the knowing quality. The second is spaciousness, the empty nature of mind. The third is naturally arising compassionate activity. So, like, imagine that in your life, whenever you're going to do something, your motivation was compassion, not do they like me? Am I getting enough? What is Fox News going to think? But what is the compassionate thing? to right. help me, to help other people. Compassion is it's not an emotion. It's the open heart meeting the suffering of the world, including your own suffering. And yeah. And to the extent that I'm just resting in that compassion and saying, what's the thing I can do right now that's most compassionate for me, for Duncan, for the audience? How can I be in my body? How can I be expressing myself so that the most healing happens in the world? And as I'm doing that, it's not me doing it anymore then, because the heart is fundamentally spacious and sky-like. So it's not me who's doing compassion. It's I am compassion, and the I even then dissolves in the compassion.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this to me, this is where the rubber hits the road, especially these days. You know, it's always been true, but in the right now, this like it seems like that what people think compassion is the opposite. I mean, the Kali Yuga version of compassion is rejecting people who have different who don't agree with you. You're rejecting people whose current views you have decided to make their eternal view.
Yeah,
forgetting that at one point you also had crazy ideas. So you don't even, people are encountering each other in this terrible way where they feel like, well, yeah, I'm not being compassionate to the Nazi, but I'm being compassionate to all the people who aren't the Nazi by rejecting the Nazi.
Got it.
And you know what I mean? This is where we're running into some real trouble. I was like, God forgive me. Don't take this the wrong way, but I was trying to deep fake Martin Luther King's voice the other day. And I'm listening to this speech he's giving on nonviolence.
Right.
And oh my God, this articulation of like, it doesn't work. It's not effective. It's not going to bring us any closer to where we want to be. We're outnumbered. We're outgunned. We can't fight that way. It just isn't going to succeed. And it's so beautiful, and it's not just bullshit like, you know, cowardice disguised as sophistication. It's the bravest thing you ever heard. He died because of saying stuff like that. And so it's so to me, you know, whenever I run into the situation of realizing, like, my God, this person thinks they're so great. They feel so compassionate. They feel like they're helping the world. By rejecting, reviling, humiliating, shaming. You know what I mean? When
yeah.
they're not helping anything other than they're just pouring gas on the fire.
So once again, one of the qualities of the open heart is connectedness. And one of the qualities of grief, or the quality of grief, is separation. Mm. And Rumi has this great line, grief is the garden of compassion. Garden is this place where something wonderful, beautiful, tasty grows.
Wow.
So that the one big chunk of spiritual life is transmuting separation and grief into connectedness and compassion. Wow. And to me, it's really impossible to heal the world through divisiveness. The Democrats are saying the Republicans are destroying the Republic, and the Republicans are saying the Democrats are destroying it. We can't trust each other. There was some statistic I was reading a couple days ago in the New York Times, something like 80% of Republicans think that Democrats are evil or something like that. And 60-some percent of Democrats think that Republicans are evil. And that if we just let them do what they want to do, they're going to destroy the country. And, you know, at the same time, I work with dying people. And in the beginning, I thought my job was to rescue people, to go in there and help them die better. But the more I've done this, I realize that suffering is only suffering. I don't say that to people, but that cancer doesn't cause suffering. Resistance to cancer causes suffering. Republicans don't cause suffering. Resistance to Republicans cause suffering, right?
Yeah.
So that if we can begin to see how we're creating the suffering, if we can begin to realize that when you are dying, Donald Trump and Joe Biden are going to be on opposite sides of your bed as you're dying, smiling at you.
Ah, it's terrible.
But
don't tell that to anybody ever again.
they're not going to be there, but the place where you automatically make that shrieking noise is going to be there in you.
Yeah.
Right? So that as long as that stuff is unconscious, it's holding us down. It's pulling us down. And that spiritual life is making conscious with that which is previously unconscious. That by seeing all this divisiveness, and the thing I was saying before about dying people, I kind of lost my train of thought, that sometimes you have to suffer more before you get to the point where you say, I'm willing to get out of here. That, like in the 12 steps, the first step is you admit how messed up it is and that it's out of control for you, right? So that as long as you think, I can do this no matter how screwed up it is, no matter how fucked up the politics are, the climate is. But when we individually and collectively get to the point where we have to surrender and say, I'm a patient, I'm willing to suffer now, I'm willing to see this is how bad it is, and I can open to this, I can be with this, I can have compassion for this, then change and healing and connection is going to happen. But you've got to admit you're stuck in that place in the first place, and collectively we haven't done that. So maybe through climate change and war and pandemic, how many billions of people have to die to get the message? I don't know.
Look, you know, I think the first step is stop aligning yourself with any political party. I've realized I've been doing that. It's like, what am I doing? They got me. You ever been around a huckster? And a huckster will, like, what they do is, like, you'll voice some opinion, this or that. And the huckster will be like, oh, you're smart. You're one of us. And you're like, no. If you're looking for friends or you're lonely, you'll be like, oh, I guess I am. What else do you believe? You know, and then they'll tell you, oh, we believe this, that, that. Like, oh, okay, I'll believe that too, even though you might not.
Right.
And, you know, and this is to me, like, this stupid political division in the world is so dumb. It compartmentalizes people. It freezes people into, like, oh, whatever way you're believing now is the way you're always going to believe. It tribalizes. And to me, like, we all, like, if you want to take a break, you want, like, you don't want, you, by the way, I shrieked not because Trump and Biden were sitting at the edge of my bed, but because they weren't in bed with me.
You poor boy.
Making love to me.
Right.
I just love American presidents. They're so sexy. Let's let go of this thing, man. Let's just for a second erase whatever the hell you think your party is or the other parties. It's really fun. It's really fun to just be like, I'm neither of those things. And no, I'm not a centrist. And no, I'm not a libertarian. No, I'm not an anarchist. I'm not a communist. You guys can play that game. It's really fun. I recommend it. I mean, I don't mean to, like, derail the beautiful things you're saying into political commentary, but I think part of the letting go situation here, the compassion situation here, is step one is you got to stop saying you're this or that. Just let go of it.
Right.
It's really quite liberating. I mean, they did a good job making people think you're going to be one or the other. They did a really good job there, both sides. Like, congratulations. It worked. You've got everyone thinking I'm this or that. It's almost heresy to say that, isn't it? Like, you're not supposed to say that. But I think that letting go of that binary is really healthy for people.
No matter what side of the aisle you're on, when you're caught in that divisiveness, there's suffering. And the problem is people are so into their concepts, they don't know they're suffering. The first step is you got to slow down enough to feel what you're feeling.
Yes.
And it, like when Ram Dass said, he pointed his head, you said, you got to get out of your head into your heart. As long as you're in your head, you're not feeling how you're suffering. And getting down into your body, getting down to your heart, even down into your belly, then you begin to feel the pain. You begin to feel the suffering. You begin to feel that abyss that we were talking about before. But like, politics is pretty much done from the head, from concepts, and some concepts are appealing to somebody's, the other concepts appealing to somebody else. But Martin Luther King and Gandhi and Nelson Mandela and the people that really did create change, even though they got killed along the way, some of them, change often happens through some charismatic figure who is able to be nonviolent and connect with people. And I mean, it's a tricky thing because, like in Tibet, the Dalai Lama was nonviolent toward the Chinese and they just took over the country and raped, tortured, and killed. Right. And a lot of young Tibetans feel that they should have been more violent, more aggressive in dealing with the Chinese, having some asymmetrical terrorism going on there.
So, oh, yeah, I'm sure that the Tibetan Buddhists would really be able to repel an attack by the People's Republic of China. That seems to be not very long. I don't know. How long are you going to be able to hang on up there? It wouldn't have worked.
Well, the North Vietnamese beat the American army when you think about it.
Yeah, but I mean, we're talking about one of the most like powerful militaries on Earth. Last I checked, that Tibetans weren't exactly like a powerful military, unless I just...
No, they weren't. They had a few
months. They didn't have an air force. What do they have, a tank? They didn't have like Buddhist tanks. Like, they were sitting ducks. I mean, I'm sorry. I have no offense to anyone out there. I mean, I understand. I mean, God knows when you see what's happened and you read stories about it was like before the invasion, you see like they've got a Kodak shop there now.
Yeah.
It's the most rancid thing you've ever seen in your life. I could understand why people would think we should have started. At least we could have taken a few out. But I don't think it would have been very effective based on my very limited understanding of the Chinese military versus the Tibetan non-military. No, they didn't have a military. Well, they have a name. What did they have? They didn't have any muskets. Old cars and muskets.
Well, but going back to the point, though, I mean, the Buddha even said that hatred is not healed by hatred, but by love alone. And, you know, love is kind of corny. I have these groups I teach. I have a really big one on Saturdays. In fact, anybody can just come to the Living Dying Project, livingdying.org, and sign up for this free spiritual support group we have every other Saturday morning. But
what
like
time?
When I say the words,
sorry,
9
what
to
time?
11, 9 to 11 California time.
Okay.
But the point, and I'm doing an in-person retreat at Holyoak Farm up in British Columbia, May 10th through 14th.
Oh, wow. Cool.
But the point I'm making is that, like, if I talk about love and God, I don't know what people are hearing because I've got my wounds about love and God from growing up as a Lutheran, and other people are Catholic and Jewish and atheist. And so when we use those terms, like, all you need is love, and the Beatles say all you need is love, it's a kind of a vague concept. And can we really trust the surrender that Ram Dass was pointing to in the swimming pool, of trusting that we don't have to understand? The Bible talks about the peace that passes understanding, right? That you don't have to stand under all the stuff you know. You can just, that's there. You've got your training, you've got your degree, you've got your knowledge, whatever it is. But what we really trust is our connectedness with each other, with the Sangha, with life, with ourselves.
Okay, I got something for that. I'll read it. If you don't mind, may I read a quick poem? I know we're running out of time here. This was sent. Do you mind? You got to.
No. Go for it.
A few more. Okay. So I, one of my the first Buddhist teachers was this wonderful person named Tejo Munich, and she teaches in Asheville at this place called the Great Tree Temple. Anyway, we had a wonderful like podcast on Saturday. And greattreetemple.org for folks who might be interested. And she sent me this. She's a Zen priest. And she sent me this. And she's the real deal, man. Like, and she, after our conversation, she sent me this poem. It reminds me of what you just said. By, how do you say it? Rilke?
Rilke.
Be patient toward all that is unsolved in your heart. And try to love the questions themselves, like locked rooms and like books that are now written in a very foreign tongue. Do not now seek the answers which cannot be given you because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps you will then gradually, without noticing it, live along some distant day into the answer.
Wow, that's beautiful.
Isn't that awesome? Well, we got to keep doing these podcasts.
Let's do another one sometime. It's always fun.
You know, before I canceled the one I had to cancel on you, I dreamed about you the night before. It was really weird. We were like in some bizarre hotel with Ram Dass hanging out. I can't remember the details, but I didn't even. I looked at my calendar. I was like, holy shit, I have a podcast with Ram Dass. I dreamed about him last night. So we're hanging out in the astral realm, it seems like.
Let me tell you a thing that happened to me. I was leading a group on Sunday. Somebody else was talking on Zoom. And I closed my eyes, and I could see Mr. Tiwari's face. It's just floating there in front of me.
Wow.
And I just felt that, you know, Maharaji said to him, you should take care of the Westerners after I go, or something like that. And I just felt he was there supporting me. He's such a sweet, lovable, such a wonderful human being. Anyway.
K.C. Tiwari. What's the doc that just came out about him?
Brilliant Disguise.
Brilliant Disguise. That's
a great
movie.
If you ever get a chance to see it, it's just a lovely movie.
Ram Dass, thank you so much. Will you again let people know about your weekly meeting on Saturdays, as well as the upcoming retreat you have, in case folks listening want to come hang out with you?
Yeah. We'll put it in the show notes.
Okay, great. Ram Dass, thank you so much. Thank you. I love our conversations.
My pleasure.
I feed on them for weeks after. I can't wait till the next one.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for being here with me.
My pleasure. See you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Ram Dass. Don't forget to go to his retreat. Go to the Living Dying Project to find out more information, or you can find it at DuncanTrussell.com. A tremendous thank you to our sponsors, and thank you for listening. I'll see you next time.